This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
I would think that the biggest consequence has been a sense of humility, because up until that year, I sort of assumed that I was in charge of my life.
I just had to learn how to be humble. I had to learn humility.
And I relinquished control. And it was a very strange, liberating feeling. More of a sense of, I'm here, but I'm a tool.
And people say to me, how long are you going to keep doing this? I think I'll do it till I drop dead.
But I had nothing handed to me. I had to go out and look for it. I had to find it.
Well, quit flapping your lips and do something. That's my attitude.
And all right. There I went. Because I felt like I was there to learn something. And I kept learning, learning, learning.
Hello, and welcome to Hitchhiking Off the Map. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller.
From our studio in Sebastopol, California. And this is a show about journeys. And normally, when we're driving down to San Francisco from here on Highway 116, we usually stop at a kind of funky, wonderful coffee stand called Hardcore Espresso.
This is not a commercial plug. They just have wonderful, wonderful coffee.
Yeah, and you have to make sure you really tighten your lid on the coffee cup and don't start to drink till you're out of the parking lot, because the potholes will pitch it all over you. So these journeys are about the richness of the coffee and the presence of the potholes. And today?
Today to Albania and Kosovo. What does a devastated, war-torn country really need? Storytellers?
I visited Sandy and Tom Farley, and they showed me their travel snapshots.
Ah, here's the brick wall. The Serb police station that the U.S. and NATO bombed. And this is a big bomb crater at the Serb army base, and that's an Ukso. We've circled there as an unexploded bomb. And playing with the kids in the brickyard. This is a typical brickyard family, mother, two kids, no father. And I'm folding origami
right.
with the kids.
But you can also see in this that there are kids with sores on their faces and effects of...
I would say that my life is relatively unremarkable. I'm a married woman with two children, and I teach school. This is pretty ordinary. And then there are other things in my life that are very extraordinary. And that's come through the work with the Quakers. I'm a member of the Religious Society of Friends. So in the spring of 99... I started getting visions in meeting for worship of people dressed in white walking across the fields of Kosovo and disarming the country. And I kept seeing the same pictures over and over again, and it was clear at some point that I was one of those people. And I was frightened and I was scared, because I also saw in those pictures people being hit by landmines and limbs blown off and other gory things. And so these images stayed with me, and I couldn't shake them. So I went to my friends' meeting, and I said, help. And they appointed a clearness committee, and that's a group of people who help you clarify what's going on. And I told them what I'd seen and what I felt that I was being called to go there. And they said, well, if you go there, it might not look like those visions. What do you think those visions really mean? And I said, well, I thought that they were symbolic of surrounding the people there with our love. They said, okay, hang on to that, because you're not going to get the specifics. And as a matter of fact, I never did walk across fields wearing white. It would have been foolhardy to walk across any fields. You never walk on anything that wasn't paved because of landmines.
So in July and August of 99, right after the war, Sandy Farley went to Kosovo to work with a group called Balkan Sunflowers.
I got a message from Sandy that as to what she was going to do.
and they would be out of communication of phone or email for about 3.5 weeks. And before they left, they had to take mine awareness training so that because there were safety concerns for everyone. And of course, I'm getting this message saying, okay, and I have no chance to respond to it.
Oh, we've been married 30 years.
But I also was aware that our friend Alan, who was with her, is someone who has experience of mines and so on, because he comes from a family where there are people who do demolition work. And one of the customs of Friends is that you don't send people alone on this. If possible, you send somebody with them. So this is where our friend Alan kind of came into this. He had that response, oh, if Sandy's going to do this, I should go with her. And he felt a connection with this work.
This is the town of Jakova. It's two pictures of before and after. So much of the old town of Jakova was bombed by the Serbian paramilitaries. They would just firebomb the shops, and everything inside the little shop would burn up, and the rafters would burn, and then all the roof tiles would fall into the middle, and there'd be this pile of rubble.
And they had a day where they cleaned everything up, and shop by shop pulled it all out to the street and hauled it away to the dumps so they could rebuild.
There were 6 or 7 of us at the volunteer house in Jakova. They had an after-school program with kids, and then we also had a morning program out at the brickworks that is now being used as a transit camp for internally displaced persons. And so those kids were still basically refugees because the villages that they had come from had been so completely destroyed there was nothing to go back to. And the difference between the children was amazing. I mean, these are children of the same nationality, same kind of background, whatever, but the kids who were still in the refugee camp were less able to concentrate on things, less able to do multi-step processes. One time, Alan and I sat with them and been doing juggling back and forth, just tossing the ball back and forth to people, and we tried to make a pattern with the group of kids. It took us most of the morning to develop a pattern ball exchange with the kids, something that we do here with kids, and they get it the first time or maybe the second time around. And it wasn't just linguistic problems. It was just, you know, the concept of waiting your turn. But once they got it, they were so excited about what happened because it looked like this big juggling thing with all these balls flying back and forth across the circle, and only each one was following the same pattern in succession going around the circle. When I got to Jakova, I eventually did find a little bit of English teaching work in the afternoons with some of the kids, and one of the interesting things that happened there were one day a couple of girls came and wanted to join the class, and some of the other students said, no, they can't join the class. And I discovered that the reason was that they were Roma. And I said, they want to learn English? They can be in my class. I'm teaching English to anyone who wants to learn English. And I sat those girls down next to a couple of adults who'd been sitting in on the class because I figured the adults would be cool. And they were. I have a picture here of some kids with a homemade go-kart. They had to keep stop and put the wheels back on.
The front assembly kept falling off. It's made out entirely out of recycled parts, bits of old desks and casters off of who knows what and so on. And they kind of posed for me to take a picture of this.
I've been there 4 times. Tom's been there once. When I first got there, almost every night a house would burn down. And I inquired about a house that was smoldering one morning as I walked past it and said, oh, isn't that too bad? And they said, no, it's not. That house belonged to the Serbian police chief. Oh. And then I discovered that all the houses that were being burned were houses that had belonged to Serbs. And I asked Arben, didn't he think it was kind of a shame that these houses were being burned? And he said, no, they're Serb houses. I said, but there aren't quite enough houses and winter is coming. Isn't this a problem? And he said, I'd rather sleep in the streets than sleep in a Serb house. At that point, I realized how deep the animosity was and realized that there was a lot more that needed to be done besides just playing games with the children. One kid, whose picture is right here in the middle, was one of these guys who was always a little problem kid in the groups, and you know, just a little bit of work and sabotage will destroy everything, so it gives you a real sense of power. But here he is in this group with the dancing, and he's got this little girl in his arms. It's his younger sister who was too tired to dance, so he's carrying her in the dance. I love it, you know? I was expecting culture shock, but I kind of live in permanent culture dissonance with the mainline culture because I'm not part of the consumer culture in many ways. So it is a different feeling when you're there. It is a different world, but it's feeling less separate each time I go. The last time I went, the fourth visit, therefore, the board meeting of the Balkan Sunflowers, I'm now serving on the board, and we were at meeting in Pristina, and the meeting was for September 8th and 9th, 2001. And so I was there, and I was staying with the Nura family in Pristina again. And so Monday I went and did some shopping and arranged to go visit my friend down in Jakova again, the English teacher. So we'd had our coffee, and then we were fixing our lunch together, and she told me something very disturbing. She'd gotten a phone call from a former neighbor in their apartment building, a Serbian man who had apparently fled back to Serbia during the Troubles. And he telephoned saying, "I should have killed your son, Dardan. I should have killed your daughters. I am going to come back and take care of this job, and I'll take care of you and your husband while I'm at it. See you soon." Hang up the phone. And she was devastated. She told her husband, but she hadn't told her children because she didn't know what to say. And but she told me about it, and I didn't know what to say either, except that poor man, he must really be hard up for something to do to make telephone threats.
2 years after the war is over, this is.
So that night, I went back to Pristina, and this was September 10th, and told my friends there what had happened, and they said, "Oh, they're still making those phone calls? We used to get those a lot right after the war." And my son would answer the phone, and he would say, "Yeah, come on over. I'll fix you a cup of coffee." This was September 10th. September 11th, I got a phone call from the director of Balkan Sunflowers saying, "You might not want to fly back tomorrow as you have planned, because there's people flying airplanes into buildings in the United States." I said, "What?" it was frightening, and it was interesting how I felt a sense of being enfolded by this family, saying, "Oh, you're experiencing grief. We know about grief. Sit here with us." Wow. And they knew about terrorism. They'd experienced it. They knew about buildings getting bombed. They'd experienced it. And it was a quite different experience being there than I think for people who were here at the time.
Now, those are our friends in Pristina, Mohammed and Salima Nura.
That's the rug weaver at her loom, which is sitting in her bedroom, and they're building an addition to the house so she can have a room for weaving.
Now, here's pictures of the countryside. It looks like the area around San Luis Obispo, or Salinas, or the foothills east of Fresno.
In Albania, on my second trip, this poor suburb of Tirana, we had a meeting one day about what we could do for Bathora and besides the children's recreation program that we were doing there. And we figured out that we could do a micro-lending program based on the Grameen Bank model that would start with about $5,000 capital investment and $5,000 maybe for getting things organized. And so we set about raising the money. I did it very easily. And when but it took 6 months to get the loan program in place. But the first two meetings of the board of directors of that micro lending bank took place in the December of 99. And I found, much to my surprise, that for at least 2 weeks, I was chairman of the board of a bank. It's just not my thing, you know. But this, they started making loans in September, in June of 2000. And they loaned it out to these little entrepreneurship groups of five or six people. And they were small loans, maximum $700 on weekly installments and for a six-month term. And all kinds of wonderful little things, like the shoemaker who was going to get a stitching machine and the weaver who got a new loom and so on.
Actually, they started off with $7,000 in like June or something, at the beginning of the summer. And so we'd added $5,000 in August, I think. A year later, we were told that in the first year cycle, they had loaned out $22,000 using that $12,000 without any additional capital investment into it, had turned over that much, that almost all of their loans were being repaid on time in full. Once in a while, there was somebody who had to reschedule a loan due to unforeseen circumstances, but you know they were getting an amazing 99% kind of on-time repayment. When I came with Sandy to see this community that she'd been telling me in what bad condition it was, there were drainage ditches being put in, and we saw little grocery stores and variety store and the weavers, shoemaker's shop, and he had a pile of stone for building an addition onto his shop.
I asked Sandy and Tom to tell one of the stories they told in Kosovo, so they did. It's a story about an abusive husband, and you need to remember that this comes out of a tradition, many traditions actually, where it was not as possible to say, well, just leave the bastard, any more than the Albanians or the Serbs or the Kosovars can say, just leave. It really has to do with being married to a savage world and the potential and the cost of reconciliation. The Tiger's Whisker.
Once upon a time, there was a woman who lived in Korea, and her husband returned after some period of service in the military and was a changed man. He was rough with her. He was hard on the children, and he just wasn't himself again. And so she went to visit an herbalist in the town. She said, do you have a love potion that you can make that will return my husband to the loving man he used to be?
Yes, said the herbalist, I do. But you must collect the ingredients and bring them to me. And he gave her a list of herbs and medicinal plants that were common in the area, nothing particularly unusual. And then at last said, and, it's one more thing, you must bring me a whisker from a living tiger, clipped from the tiger with his permission.
The woman's heart sank. But as she walked back home, she thought about how she might approach it. And she saved some meat from her lunch. And that afternoon, when her husband returned to the fields, she went through the woods to the cave where the tiger was known to live and put a bowl with some meat in it in front of the tiger's cave. And then she pulled back into the woods and hid to watch. And the tiger did come out and eat the meat. The next day she did the same, and every day for a week hiding in the woods to watch the tiger eat. The second week she stood just a little closer, still in the woods, but in front of the tree instead of behind the tree, and each day watched the tiger eat. The third week she stood a good deal closer. By the fourth week, she was standing right next to the cave while the tiger came out to eat. And the fifth week, she sat there with the bowl of food in her lap, and the tiger came and ate it. And then she said, "Tiger, please, may I have permission to take one of your whiskers?" And the tiger nodded his head, and she took a pair of scissors from her apron pocket and clipped a whisker from the tiger, put it carefully in her pocket. And when the tiger had finished eating, she took off and nearly flew back to the herbalist. She had to stop at her house and pick up all the herbs that she had collected. And she grabbed that basket and ran to the herbalist and said, "Here it is, I've got everything."
Well, the herbalist looked through the basket. Yes, fine. Everything is here. And the whisker?
Yes, here is the tiger's whisker.
And he took it and held it up and looked at it. Ah, very good. And he reached out and tossed it into the fire.
What have you done? Have any idea how much work I went through to get that whisker? I went every day to the woods for more than a month and waited so patiently for that tiger to eat. And I sweated blood for that tiger. You would not believe how much I went through just to feed that tiger and to get the stuff. And you have thrown it away, all this work you have just tossed in the stove.
The herbalist finally calmed her down and said, "And is your husband any more fierce or wild than the tiger?"
And then she knew what she had to do.
In Belvedere, California, we were talking with Sandy and Tom Farley. Their website is www.spant.com.
And this is Hitchhiking Off the Map. Thinking about that story, which might set some people's teeth on edge, implying that, well, it's the woman's job to bring about the reconciliation. But I guess it's anybody's job who's capable of doing the job, and this is about finding the strength. So it brought to mind the story of my mother's teeth.
Conrad's mother was an amazing woman and very beautiful.
She was. But even when I was very small, she would have been in her mid-30s then, she had lost most of her teeth. She had her lower front teeth, but the upper teeth were gone, except for two cuspids that anchored her upper denture. I remember crawling up in her lap and saying, "Mama, take out your teeth." And sometimes, if she was in the right mood, she would, and give me a scraggly grimace. But this is about a journey to the tax office. I was about 4. She and I lived in, literally, a shack, down in the wrong end of Council Bluffs, Iowa. 2 rooms, the outside was covered with tar paper, no plumbing, just an outdoor pump and an outhouse, coal stove, rats. She had a job, but she had to pay for all-day childcare, and there were times when meals were scant. So this was the lady who came under the scrutiny of the IRS. She was called into the tax office. Her dental work had left her with few teeth and even fewer dollars, and she had claimed a medical deduction. So the taxman asked, "Where's your receipt?" Now, the odd thing to me is that knowing my mother's vehement exactitude with money and accounts, over the next 30 years she was a bookkeeper, she didn't have a receipt. But she didn't. "So where's the receipt for this?" he asked. "The dentist didn't give me one." "Well, go back and get one." "He died. He was an old guy, that's why he was cheap." "What about the canceled check?" "He only took cash." So they went round and round, and clearly he wasn't going to allow this deduction, and she had no money to pay more tax, and so they would garnish her wages, and she would have even less for her dentures to chew on. My mother was not a violent woman, or loud, but she had the tenure and courage of a tree stump. At some point, in heated discussions with store clerks, teachers, doctors, neighbors, the supervisors, people who were telling her what could or could not be done, she would simply say the same thing over and over and over and stand there till hell froze. And so, faced with the armed might of the federal government in the shape of a ratty little tax man, she gave him what he asked. She stood up, put her fingers in her mouth, pulled out her upper denture, laid it on the desk in front of him. Her two dog teeth framing her bare gums, she said, "There's my receipt." She got her deduction.
May we all have strength. Hitchhiking Off the Map is produced by The Independent Eye, with funding from the National Endowment for the Arts.
And from the Hitchhikers Guild. Visit our website where you can hear all of our shows, www.independenteye.org. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller. Peace and joy.
But those kids, at one point, I'd brought my camera to take pictures one day, and so I'd stepped out of the circle to take pictures, and we looked back and realized that the game was continuing, and none of the volunteer leaders were there. The kids were doing it themselves. Did I ever feel great? I mean, that was just one of those marvelous things where, like, they had internalized the process. Once we got the game started, they would do it. And then I realized then how much less time it was taking for them to make a circle. When we'd come up and say, Nireth, which means one circle, they had their circle together because they knew that something fun was going to happen next. And that whole community was beginning to pull together and see that they had some future.